Good morning. Let me welcome all of you, members of the Standing Committee on Appropriation, the Minister, and the officials of the Department of Higher Education and Training, our support staff. I see the office of the Parliamentary Budget Office. Welcome. We also welcome the liaison officer of the National Treasury. Are the office or official from National Treasury?
No.
Thank you. You're all welcome to this meeting in which the Department of Higher Education has been invited by the Standing Committee to brief the committee basically on the issues of the Appropriation Bill 2015-16 as the brief that was sent to the department. I shall not read the points, the contents of the brief, because all of us, I'm sure, are aware of. Besides reiterating that currently the Standing Committee on Appropriation is processing the Appropriation Bill 2015, and therefore the issues that would largely constitute this meeting would be talking to the bill, and of course issues of performance of the department with regard to its expenditure and so on. But before we proceed with the meeting, let me just indicate the apologies that we've received. The chairperson, Honorable Paul Mashadile, is unavailable. He's been out of the country, and although his back is just about his back, he is not able to be present in the meeting, but he will be joining us later in the day and in the course of this week. We have also received apologies from Honorable Law of the EFF and Honorable Sheikh Imam from the NFP. We haven't received an apology from the UDL, and I don't see them yet. But those are the apologies that we have. Members, are the apologies accepted? Let me hear one voice. Honorable McLaughlin. Thank you very much. Let's move on to the presentation by the department. But before that, let me also appreciate the presence of the minister in our meeting, Minister Nzimande, which indicates to us that indeed the executive does take seriously the work the parliament does and the oversight that parliament exercises over the executive and the department. And so we appreciate your presence, Honorable Minister. Let's go on to the presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Babaza, and to all the members of the Standing Committee. And senior officials present here, led by our DG, Mr. Kwebsonde. Sir President, thank you very much for the invitation to come to the Standing Committee on Appropriations. I must say it's the first time for me that I have an opportunity to interact with this committee, and I'm looking forward to that. Of course, the main presentation is going to be made by the DG and his senior management team. But I just thought that it's important on my part just to introduce and give a bit of background and context to what will be presented here today. Firstly, our department now is what, 6 years old? Just about. Still a new department by government standards. When we were formed, we defined our core mandate, something that we think is very important in terms of the committee's evaluation of our work. Our core mandate is that of providing expanded and diverse post-school education and training opportunities to both youth and adults. Now, the concept and mandate is very important to us. By the way, the education discourse, the concept of post-school education and training is relatively new. And what it seeks to capture is the core of the challenges that face South Africa. That is, the need to systematically cater for education and training needs of all South African youth and adults that are out of school, including those who have never been to school, including those who might have left school very early. Now, if we estimate, for instance, a person, which is, I think, a piece of information that is very important for the committee to understand. We estimate, in terms of our own research, that there are 18 million South Africans, as we speak now, who are no longer at school, but who require some form of adult education and training of some sort of one kind or the other. Now, 18 million, just to give the community an idea, is larger than the schooling population, the university population, and the technical and vocational education and training population combined. So it's a huge challenge. Now, you may ask, why do we do this? People want to break a pattern that has been established in our education system that has caused us problems. Historically, it's also part of our colonial heritage that being educated means going to school and doing an academic matric and go to university. If you don't go that route, that's the end of your life or opportunity. We are not saying that university is not important. It's very important, as we will also be illustrating. But this route has excluded millions of other South Africans who have not gone through this route. Now, also this concept, this idea of post-school education training is also based on the concept of lifelong learning, that we want to promote a learning nation. And also we want to create opportunities for every South African who is no longer at school, if he or she wants a further education and training opportunity, there must be a place where the South African must go to. Now, for example, okay, maybe before I give you this example, what is important also in this concept of post-school is that we have not had diverse opportunities for people to do a whole range of other things that they need. Now, let me give an example. Take our adult education and training center. They basically are providing one kind of education, which is those who want to finish school, what we used to call NICU. That's what they do. Almost exclusive. Yet the needs of South Africans are so diverse. I'm thinking, for instance, of an adult who has left school in the rural area who want to learn fencing. because fence is important to protect livestock in the rural areas, by way of example. That cattle have nowhere to go today. A young woman is not in high school who is only interested in learning how to bake in order to go and sell somewhere and be able to make a living. Now, we want, therefore, to expand post-school education and training such that it provides a whole range of opportunities. If I may give also quickly another example, you know, there is this pressure on us to reopen former teacher training colleges. Well, we respect that call. But when you examine that call closely, it's problematic. Because it also assumes that everybody must go and be a teacher. We must increase the number of teachers, almost irrespective of the needs that we have. Why, though? It's because historically, those teacher training colleges provided post-school opportunities to many youngsters who never had them. But we want to expand that. We need teachers in the same way as we need plumbers, electricians, and a whole range of other skills and occupations and trades, which we are short of, by the way, in South Africa. Whether it's welders, you know, and many other types. So we do need a balance. So we want to create a system that is going to hopefully end up striking that particular balance. One way through which we are trying to expand this post-school education and training, for instance, we are creating a new institution that we never had in our country, which we are going to be referring to as community colleges. Community colleges will absorb the existing adult education and training centers, but also expand along the lines that I was suggesting. That is also, they are also able to offer skills. The way we see community colleges, which we are piloting as from next year, PDNRI, is that there shall be no entry requirements whatsoever. Whether you have gone to school or not, that will not get determined. If you are not going to school, you must come into the community college, then the community college must be able to take you through AEOU. All right. If you like school in standard 2, you want to do a particular skill, the community college will have to prepare to be able to acquire that skill. Because we still have large numbers of South Africans who never finish school. Huge percentage who never went beyond primary school. What do you do with those South Africans? There is no place to go away living human beings, the dustbin. We have to provide opportunities. Now, being this committee that you are, Chair, there is another question. I know it's a complex and difficult one, but we have to say this. In terms of what we call equitable share of the budget, we are of the view that there is money that is going to other departments on the assumption that they are dealing with the problems that actually the Department of Education and Training is dealing with. We tend to assume that youth between certain ages is supposed to be at school. And yet that's not the case. But we don't get that money in the Department of Education and Training because we are the ones who must cater for them and who are actually catering for them. So as the standing committee, one issue that we would like to pose to you to take into account when actually looking at the budget of our own department. Because once anybody, even if we are 14-year-old, we are out of school, you want further education and training opportunity, you don't want to go back to basic education to a school. We have to provide with an opportunity through our adult learning centers and so on. Lastly, Chair, our idea of post-school education and training also has elevated the workplace as a very important space for education and training. This is something that we need to really look into because there is a lot of education and training that takes place in the workplace. But we still think it's not enough for you. Workplaces, both in the private and the public sector, need to be opened even more to provide workplace experience for those who are coming, as well as the training of workers who are already in those workspaces and providing further opportunities if they want to advance themselves. Another emphasis that we are actually placing as part of this concept of post-school education and training in order to respond to the needs of South Africa. I'm not going to say much more. If in the other background that I was going to be talking about, I will leave that to you. Except as I say, we need, I know every department that comes to you is going to say this, but I hope that we've added our case quite urgently. For example, the ruling party took a resolution at its Mangaung conference to say all former colleges of education building, the infrastructure must be taken over by us to provide post-school education and training opportunities. We've identified those, but there's no money. We don't have much money to be able to actually run those. Some of them are still going to remain unused. There are certain, not because we don't want to, but because there just isn't enough funding given the scale at which we actually are having these challenges. One of the things we are trying to do to deal with that in the meantime is to begin to look at how do we use existing institutions to serve a multi-purpose educational function. For instance, the one that I think is going to be starting very soon is in Guyana. Yeah. We at least just one college we are able to take over, but not the others. We are now going to have that from Guyana College of Education to offer university programs and at the same time offer technical and vocational education and training projects as well as become community college at the same time. So everything. It will really, we're piloting this idea of multi-purpose education centers. The DG also has undertaken through his team a process of auditing how are our institutions used. If a college gets used from 8 to 2, that infrastructure is wasted between 2 in the afternoon and 8 in the evening, for instance, when we could actually be building in other programs. But in those other programs, we don't have enough money to be able to do that. And the need is huge. As we say, we estimate minimum 18 million South Africans. Yet the other education and training centers only have 300,000 at the moment. So I thought that I would give that background. I hope that DG, I haven't taken too much from your time in the presentation. But Chairperson, thank you very much for your indulgence. Then, as I say, I'm raising this so that when you then look at our presentation, it's going to be led by the DG. You also contextualize it and evaluate it from the background and the context that I've given. Thank you very much.
Let me hand over to the DG to proceed with the presentation.
Thank you, Sir Dudley, Minister of Education and Training, members of the committee, my colleagues in the department, as well as people who have attended this meeting. The outline of our presentation is shown at slide 2, of which I won't be going through it because we'll be dealing with those issues quite in detail as we proceed with our presentation. The strategic overview of the Department of Higher Education and Training is that we are responsible for all school education and training in the entire country, as the Minister has eloquently explained. It is a coordinating department of Outcome 5 of government's 14 outcomes, of which ours, which is Outcome 5, is a skilled and capable workforce to support an inclusive growth path. In 2014, the department released a white paper for post-school education and training, which actually outlined as to how do we see the entire system integrating and fulfilling its mandate. White paper has created a framework that defines the department's vision for PSET, its focus and priorities thereof. So the strategic plan covers the period 2015-2020 and is informed by the vision espoused in the National Development Plan 2014-2019 Medium-Term Strategic Framework and the imperatives of the White Paper. So our vision basically is leading post-school education and training for growth of the entire country in every respect. Our mission is to provide the national strategic leadership in support of an integrated post-school education and training system towards improved quality of life of the South African citizens as a whole. We've got five strategic goals, of which one to provide a sound post-school education and training legislative framework in order to operate within prescripts of a legislation. Two, to provide post-school education and training services. Three, to provide post-school education and training capacity so that we are able to fulfill our mandate in the city. Four, to facilitate a strong stakeholder network with a view of creating strategic partnerships in the work that we are doing. Strategic goal 5 is to ensure continuous business excellence within the Department of Higher Education and Training. So these goals essentially seek to improve the efficiency and effectiveness of the system as a whole, on the one hand, and also improve the quality of provision and outcome thereof in respect of the nature and the crucialness of the program that are offered within the system in its entirety. In line with the strategic goals identified, we developed and reviewed a legislative framework aimed at steering post-school education and training system in line with the imperatives of the White Paper. Strive to expand and improve the quality of post-school education and training by introducing appropriate teaching and learning support interventions for universities and technical and vocational education and training colleges, as well as artisan development. Establish, develop and expand a new institutional type, community colleges, primarily to promote education and training opportunities for those young people who cannot access the universities or TVET colleges. We seek to improve capacity of the system through infrastructure development for technical and vocational education and training as well, and to maintain good stakeholder relations in support of an effective school education and training system, and ensure good corporate governance, including efficient resource management within the department and its entities. Our focus areas in the next 5 years are to substantially expand access to education and training for youth and others, regardless of whether or not they have completed a schooling system or attained a certain level or a standard, but just everybody, and also ensuring that they succeed at the same time in the system, not just access, but also succeed. To improve the alignment between universities, TVET colleges, sector education and training authorities, South African qualification authorities, and quality councils in an effort to improve student and learner mobility across institutions and qualifications. We want here to end any prospect of one studying towards a dead end. We want the system to actually link and articulate in its offering of programs or qualifications across, to expand the availability of opportunities for workplace training for students in colleges and universities, and to expand other forms of workplace training such as learnership and apprenticeship. This is the point that the minister actually emphasized, that you train people in order at work somewhere or to undertake their own initiative. Hence, the component of work placement is one of the areas we are working hard into ensuring that we integrate in the process of training. To ensure that our post-school education and training system prioritizes funding of the marginalized, enabling them to access post-school institutions and fulfill dreams or careers thought to be unrealized. To further develop post-school graduate studies to ensure the expansion of the academic profession and development of high-level knowledge and skills, and also to diversify provision based on an open learning principle to improve learning opportunities across the post-school education and training sector by expanding and strengthening the post-school distance education landscape. The other area is to integrate disability into the broader policy arena by introducing a national policy to guide education and training institutions in the post-school domain. And the minister has established a task team or a committee that would actually look quite in detail in this area and come up with appropriate recommendations that would seek to respond quite comprehensively to the needs of this category of our citizens. And also to integrate the recognition of prior learning into the post-school education and training system as a whole. I would request the CFO to take us through in respect to some matters that would relate to financial aspects of one kind or the other. Thank you,
DG. Honorable Chairs and Members, Minister. First of all, if you look at the assessment of the 2015 appropriation bill, just very briefly on the slide number 11 and 12, it's just the five programs of the department and what happens in each program. We have the normal administration program for the leadership, management and support services of the department. The second program is our human resource development planning and monitoring coordination program that provides strategic direction in the development, implementation and monitoring of policies and the HRD strategy of South Africa. The third program is university education. Mainly within university education is the development and coordination of policy and the regulation framework for the university sector, and also providing the financial support to universities, the National Student Financial Aid Scheme, and our National Institutes for Higher Education. Program 4, the Vocational and Continuing Education and Training Program. That is where we see the technical and vocational education and training colleges, as well as post-literacy adult education and training. And in that program, they perform other plans, develop, monitor, maintain, and develop national policy programs and assessment practices and systems for vocational and continuing education and training. Program 5, our skills development program, where all the national skills development strategies are, and that is specifically within the framework of the SETA system. Here, if you look at our budget, you would note that our budget includes direct charges. These direct charges are the amounts reflected as direct commitments from the National Revenue Fund in terms of specific legislative requirements. And they are not defined as voted funds as we have for our other five programs. In our case, the direct charge, or the direct charges, is the skills levy that are being collected by the South African Revenue Services, and that is specifically for sector education and training authorities and the National Skills Fund. The direct charges only increase at an annual average rate of 9.6% from 2014-15's 13.2 billion to reach 17.4 billion in 2017-18. For the current financial year, as indicated in the appropriation bill 2015-16, the amount for direct charges will be 14.69 billion rand. you look at the 2014 NDF as a total, and besides the present budget funds, when they exclude our direct charges, we have an annual average increase of 5.9% over the NDF period from the 39 billion that we had in 2014-15 to 46.3 billion in 2017-18. The current year's budget amounts to 41.8 billion, which is a 2.9 billion increase from last year, a nominal increase of 7.3%. This allocation of 41.8 billion includes a budget cut for cost containment measures that was implemented by National Treasury, amounting to 24.5 million rand, and received additional funding from the Provincial Equitable Share for the TVET and other education and training functions that is now fully part of the department as from 1 April, and that amounted to 2.2 billion rand. On slide 15, this indication of the nature of the department's budget, if we look at the budget, we'll see that program C, university education, dominates the budget, and in total represents 78.5% of the total budget for this year. Similarly, private finance dominates our budget in terms of the economic classification of expenditure. Our normal departmental services are only around 18.67%. If we then exclude all the transfers that we pay universities, teacher colleges, our public entities, the health education training centers, other organizations, and our EMR funds. Of this, compensation of employees of 7.3 billion rand, basically as a result of all the staff for TVET and adult education and training. The remaining funds for normal operations in the department is only 505.3 million rand. And as you can see, it's only 1.2% of the budget, which is extremely small. We compare this with other government departments and even normal project management costs, where average operational cost is around 5 to 7.5%. Slide 16, this provides the indication of the allocation per program as one of the direct charges under the NTF period compared to the adjusted appropriation for 2014-15. I'm not going to go into the detail, just to flag here that university education has indicated the highest portion, followed by vocational and continuing education and training, where the TVET and IT sectors are funded. Slide 17 provides the information to economic classification, and this is where you can see the 7.3 billion increases for compensation of employees for the current year. The increases in compensation, perhaps just to flag that as well, over the years, mainly for the improvement of conditions of service, which include our examinators and moderators, where the fees that they claim, the tariff that they claim, are also linked to the current remuneration standards of government. Different services, a very small portion, and then our transfers, as indicated earlier, that dominates the budget, a total of 34 billion rand for transfers and subsidies. The biggest portion there, the subsidies to universities, that was 24.1 billion last year, it does up to 29 billion in 2017-18. Followed by then is the National Student Financial Aid Scheme that provides the bursaries and loans not only for university students but also for our TVET students. And that is currently around 6.5 billion and it grows until 7.1 billion in 2017-18. Here on slide number 18, as requested by the committee, also an indication of some of the budget pressures that face the department. Although we acknowledge the current fiscal constraints of government, one must take into account that there are various challenges that face the department, and the serious impact on the service delivery requirements of the department. We have cost containment measures in place that's been approved by the Director General to ensure that other funding mainly is paid for key service delivery priorities. We have also implemented the cost containment regulations by National Treasury and we are currently looking into ways in which effectiveness could be improved to even reduce costs further but to try and meet the same objectives. If you look at our current budget constraints, it is quite difficult for the department to attain the growth requirements, especially as indicated by the Minister earlier, with either post-school education system. That affects enrollments, that's not only for universities, student colleges, but also the community colleges. It affects infrastructure development, especially our student accommodation needs, and increased operations and student support services at all our institutions. A key shortfall remains student financial assistance through NSFAS. Now that is specifically acknowledged the last increases that we received, that there are still a huge need and that will be addressed later in the presentation. There's also limitations from the departmental operations, as I indicated earlier, only 1.2% of our total funding that goes into the normal operations of the department and for all the services that we must provide. This is very difficult due to the cutting on concentration of employees. We cannot just continue to full post and make sure that the necessary capacity in terms of staff is available. We can also not roll out the proposed staff establishment that will include regional tourism now that we finalize the function shift of the TVET and AET sectors. Also, aspects such as IT expenditure for the required connectivity of staff cannot be performed. If we look at the institutional monitoring and evaluation, what is critical is we look at the number of entities and institutions that the department manage. This is currently very limited because, although it's a critical area, sufficient funding does not exist to really perform detailed monitoring and evaluation. In the charts, specifically for universities and for TVET colleges, there will also be an indication of the monitoring and evaluation being performed, and later on also in terms of our public entities. The department can clearly rely strongly on some NSS project support funding. If you look at aspects such as the National Autism Moderation Body, this body was agreed with National Treasury some 3 years ago, just shortly after the department started, that we will start this up as an NSS project, which we did, and that over the NTS period, funding will come from the fiscus to support us in funding the activities of the body. Now, this is now 3 or 4 years later, and we are still waiting for funding from the Exchequer to assist in this regard. This is also an immediate pressure to manage TVET and IoT function shifts. This is numerous number of tasks and activities that must be performed in relation to taking over all the staff and to manage those functions at the department, and which is currently not possible in full. There are also cost implications for our examination services, especially if we look at our TVET college qualification and the general education and training eligible for qualification. The department is currently able to resolve all 9 examination cycles associated with these qualifications. There are some critical activities to the integrity and approval of release of results that have to be scaled down because we need to scale down in order to manage all those within the available budget constraints. Increasing student enrollments is also a serious impact on examination budgeting and the service delivery in this area. It is in our class 21, which also refers to also the higher education aid project, which is going to be managed by the department through NEPA, the Higher Education of South Africa. We do provide them currently with the subsidy, but this started up as the aid program for the university sector, which we now need to roll out now that the TVET is with us, and we do need all the additional financial support in order to ensure that we can effectively roll it out to the TVET sector. For 22 and 23 focus on the performance of our public entities. We currently have 21 setups and 5 other Schedule 3A public entities. And in addition, the department oversees 26 universities, the National Institute on Human and Social Sciences, There are 50 TVET colleges and more than 3,500 adult education training centers. Of these 3,500 centers are now incorporated into the 9 community education and training colleges over the country. There are numerous challenges, but the department has the necessary policies and procedures in place for the monitoring and evaluation of these entities and institutions. We are, however, not in a position to perform at its fullest extent. There are limitations on operational funding that just does not allow it. Many of the monitoring and evaluation that we do perform at the moment are mainly desktop exercises and exercises based on reports submitted by all the entities and institutions. We however ensure that all of the latest requirements for monitoring and evaluation are performed, and we do the necessary reporting to Parliament, the executive authority, and the accounting officer, and also provide feedback to our clients. All the TETAs and the other scheduled CIA public entities report to the department in terms of the provisions in the PFNA and the Treasury regulations, which include the strategic plans, the APP business level agreements, specifically for the CIAs, as well as quarterly reports and annual reports. In the case of the CIAs, SACWA, QCA, NISFA, and CHE, we are currently looking at a possible monthly financial reporting cycle to ensure that we can have a closer look at their financial performance and detect problems earlier than currently with the quarterly reporting. And this is currently under consideration. Chairperson from Clinic 4, up to slide 43, we post a bit on the university funding framework and aspects within the university sector. And I'm going to hand over to Dr. Barker, who is the DDG, specifically for university education. Thank you.
Thanks, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, Minister. It just started with the first slide, which shows us the way in which we fund universities. We are currently funding universities to about 40% of their total requirements. And we go through two major types of grants. The first is the block grant, which is subsidies, which go to universities through transfers, and they become council discretionary funds. They're utilized by the council for the operation of those universities, and the way in which we calculate the amount that goes to each university is through the various aspects of teaching inputs, how many students are there, the teaching outputs, what are the graded outputs of that institution, research outputs from the institution, and then we have institutional factors which deal with things like disadvantage, size, and so on. And that is the bulk of the funding that goes by universities. Then we have a wide variety of earmark grants, which in 2015-16 amounted to 9.8 billion. And what NISA used for is really to support and steer the system. The LIFTAS is the largest of those grants, and that goes towards supporting students in the system, both TVET and university students. And then the other grants are specifically earmarked for steering the system in terms of ensuring a sponsored university education system. The next slide shows the breakdown of funds over the NPEF. Now, I'm not going to go through that in detail, but it does give you detailed amounts for each of the various properties in the system. And we also obviously have that broken down to each institution. The earmark grants are the grants that we really use to steer the system. And these are managed and monitored by the department. Universities are given grants for specific businesses, and they have to report on those, and we also monitor them. In terms of student success, we have a number of grants which are there for us to support the system, and particularly there's the Research Development Grant, which this year is at $616.9 million, the Research Development Grant, which is at $199 million. And both of these aim to enhance the effectiveness of the university academic staff in their core roles as educators and researchers. Each institution has a teaching development plan and a research development plan that is funded through these funds. We have had significant successes in the system, and evidence shows us that success rates are rising and dropouts are falling, which is a good sign. we intend to utilize these funds more effectively in that way going forward. The challenges in terms of the earmark funds, particularly around the sustainability of the various initiatives that have been introduced, particularly the tutoring and entering programs and writing centers, because these really need to be absorbed into the university's general operational structure, but currently the funding is not available for that. If we go on to the next slide, another grant that is used specifically for student success is the Foundation Provisioning Grant, and in 2015-16 this amounts to 304.47 million. And the main purpose there is to support the academic support performance of first-time entering undergraduate students who already comply with minimum requirements enrolled for particular university qualifications but are at risk due to poor educational backgrounds. We have ministerially approved extended curricular programs, which are in most cases 1 year longer than the regular qualification, and we are supporting and growing this program going forward. In terms of cost containment measures, the main aspect here is around the monitoring of these earmark grants to ensure that the universities are utilizing them for what they ought to be utilizing them for. And we have stepped up the rigorous monitoring evaluation process in respect of it. But as the CFO has already indicated, one of the difficulties we have is around the operational costs. But as an example, last year we undertook site visits to every single institution in order to really look into what they were doing with the various development grants, particularly the teaching development grant, and to identify areas where we could create cost savings. And there we managed to identify and reprioritize 272 million in order to support a new program that we put in place, which is the New Generation of Academics program. And this program will be looking at even improving the focus on quality in the system. In terms of leveraging partnerships in order to gain additional funding, you have a number of aspects. Partnerships that have been identified more recently are partnership with the EDGB Seeker to support universities to deliver an advanced diploma in technical education and vocational teaching. We've also got a European Union sector support program funding this year for an amount of about 20 million euros that will support the strengthening of teacher education at our universities, amongst other aspects. In the Starting South African Universities program, we'll be focusing on the development of academic staff. We're working at partnerships with a number of international donors, particularly donors that are offering scholarship funds to leave a scholarship opportunity to support mobility programs, as well as having partnerships with the DSC and NRAs to ensure that the funding they put into the system matches with ours and that we lever these together to improve quality. In terms of student housing, we've been working with PRC and DBSA and other stakeholders to try and find funding models to support extended student housing. This is a real issue for us in the system because currently we only support around about 25% of students in student housing, and we have a problem with quality of that as well. And we do recognize that it's a key area for improved success of our students. We are having a student housing symposium in June to discuss this with a number of partners, possible partners. In terms of monitoring and evaluation, as it indicated already, we have a large number of earmark grants, totaling to 9.8 billion, and our greatest risk around these earmark grants is insufficient operational funds to manpower a proper monitoring program. We do believe that we should be able to use a percentage of these funds for monitoring, but this has not been approved by Treasury, so we've not been able to do that. However, to mitigate the problem, the Minister will approve a 5-year sector monitoring, evaluation and support program that will be funded through one of the earmark grants to an amount of around about 10 million per annum, and this will enable us to put together capacity to ensure that we manage and we monitor this funding effectively. As you saw in a previous slide, the teaching development grant, monitoring it is absolutely essential because it enables us to see, really able to create efficiencies and then redirect and reprioritize funding. Significant projects, we were requested to talk to some of those. One of the most significant projects that we've undertaken in the last years is the development of our two new universities, the one in Mpumalanga and the other one in the Northern Cape. Contrary to the vote, has made significant funding available for in a baseline for the 10-year infrastructure development program, and that is on track. If you go to Kimberley or you go to Mpumalanga, you will see the buildings going up there, and it's a very exciting development. But what has made that in terms of the operational funding is limited, and we do foresee a risk there. Because as we build the capacity of the institution from an infrastructure point of view and we make the space available, we need the operational funding to support the students in those institutions. And that we do see as a risk going forward. There is sufficient funding in the current MPs for the predicted growth, but the rate of growth in the operational funding is not going to match the rate of growth of the infrastructure going forward in subsequent MTs. In terms of the establishment of the Rand University, the Sefakhamakhonsa Health Sciences University, we have incorporated the Madonna campus of the University of Limpopo into that university, and the president has just launched it. But there are some challenges and risks. The Sefakhamakhonsa Health Sciences University has to develop its capacity to execute its full mandate, and we are at risk of inadequate resourcing as we expand that institution, because we are talking about a health sciences specific institution, and that's one of the most expensive areas in the system. An additional risk at that university is the adequacy of the clinical training program. We have the hospital, the academic hospital that is supported by the Department of Health, that is supposed to have been developed, but that is not on track, and it does seem that we are going to have risk around that aspect of the development for the university. But we are working with the National Development Health, the National Department of Health on that aspect. The development and expansion of medical schools in the country is something that has been pushed consistently from a health perspective to support the country's production of health professionals. And there's an expectation that we must do this. However, in order to enroll more medical doctors, we need to expand the platform, both the clinical platform and the university platform, and we need more funding to support the enrollment, increased enrollment. And so unless we get further funding to support increased enrollment, we're not going to meet those kinds of expectations for the country. And that's a major risk. We are in the process of developing a new medical school at the University of Limpopo, and this has been through an agreement between our minister and the Minister of Health. However, we have not been able to secure additional funding for that medical school, and so that medical school, again, will have to be absorbed within the current baseline for enrollment, which means the expansion will not be as expected. We are currently also in the process of seeding a new medical school at Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, and that has been done through some funding from the NSF. But if this is to become a reality, again, we'll need to look at this expansion. So the point here is that we're in this process of expanding medical education. It's an expensive aspect of our system, but we clearly are going to need to get additional resources to do this effectively. And then we also have the medical doctors that have been trained in Canada and that are coming back into the system. We are expecting them to come back at a rate of around about 1,000 per year in about 2 years' time. And when they come back, they can need to be absorbed into our medical school to complete their training. And this is another risk in the medical extension project. So with the expanding funding to universities, framework is a comprehensive new project that we are obviously implementing with re-prioritized funds, and particularly focused on a transformative initiative to change and renew the academic profession in South Africa, and focused specifically on attracting young black women academics and assisting them in that process. The first phase, the new generation academics program, has been implemented this year, and we will be appointing about 125 new permanent staff members. The challenges around this, specifically capacity in the system, and also the challenge of attracting gifted academics into the profession and sustaining this interest. We are hoping that we're going to be able to do this in a way that will really support the development and the quality in the system. Coming going forward, a new significant project is around the agriculture conscious process. We currently have a task team looking at putting in the resolution of agricultural colleges to be moved into Department of Higher Education and Training, and we'll be looking very carefully at that process to ensure that the funds come with the shift and that we mitigate that risk. And then another one is the settled application service, which is currently under construction, and we have to monitor the resistance to this because that could be a major risk to its implementation. We've already mentioned the National Financial Aid Scheme, Student Financial Aid Scheme, and here we recognize it as one of the most important schemes that the government has in terms of bringing young poor students into higher education, both into the university system and to the system. But the major shortage coming is that funds for short of demand. So although there's been significant increase, we've more or less plateaued in terms of the number of students that we're able to support. We have estimated that we will be able to support around 205,000 students over their intakes, assuming that we're able to that we went to higher increase in fees and that we didn't increase the amount of funding to each individual student. However, a lot of the data that has been provided now by research indicates that we may not even live at 205,000 from last year, and this may be due to two factors. The one specifically is the focus on increasing the amount of funding made available to individual students to ensure that they are able to be more fully supported. And the second, in relation to the issue of increasing the amount to each student. We believe that to maintain the current level of support, significant additional funding is required. The department has been quite focused on understanding how it can support historically disadvantaged institutions. And one of the aspects of the funding framework that we are busy introducing at the moment is a new grant, the Historically Disadvantaged Institutions Development Grant. This will go to each contract university who identified as slightly disadvantaged. And the only MTIS, there will be an amount of almost $2 million that will be made available over the next 5 years by that program. The purpose of this grant really is to assist these institutions to look at the current problems and to develop systems and to assist their financial health at the universities, to strengthen academic enterprise and to realize their potential. The grants are not going to be given out on a shared basis. Rather, individual institutions have been requested to do the work to identify the key problems in their institutions and they are developing plans how the funding will be utilized to deal with these issues. So the plans will be focused on, as I said, financial sustainability, but also on strengthening and streamlining academic management and administrative systems, reducing over-enrollment, improving student experience, especially at first year, and developing niche academic research areas. By the end of the 5 years, the minister will determine whether or not we need to continue with the grant, and if continued, which institutions should be supported. We will be starting out that grant as soon as we meet the needs of each of these institutions, and we have more or less managed this issue by switching the playing fields. In terms of the historically disadvantaged universities, we have been already focusing on providing funding for improved infrastructure. And what this slide shows is that the percentage of infrastructure grants that have gone to the various institutions over a period. And you will see that compared to the actual teaching in the units, which is the number of students that they support, they've had a high percentage of infrastructure support. And this is required because of the backlogs at these institutions in terms of maintenance, as well as being developed for far fewer number of students. For example, if you take the University of Venda, it was developed for 5,000 students, and it now has almost 12,000 students. So that's a huge difference in terms of it, and why we've needed to have more funding going to these institutions than to the more advanced institutions. The current funding formula has been sometimes identified as a problem for historically disadvantaged institutions. But since 2009, the various ways in which we've tried to support these institutions, particularly through earmark grants, we've seen that, in fact, it has not disadvantaged these institutions. But what this graph shows, and you can see the red bar at the end there, is the average increase over a period from 2004-05 to 2014-15 of funds to the whole system, which was around 244.4%. And then you can see for each institution what very specific increase was. So in terms of the average increase, we can see that each of the disadvantaged institutions has been well above average, which indicates that we haven't been increasing the amount of more disadvantaged students over this period of time. So we are feeling that this is a good move in the system, and we should be seeing these institutions reaching their potential as we go forward over the next 5 years. Thank you.
As the next person back on the technical and vocational education and training policy.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Minister, yes, as indicated by the DG, I'll take you through the slides relating to TVET. On page 544, the total allocation for the TVET sector is 6.1 billion. Compensation, the compensation will relate to 4.9 billion, subsidies 1.1, and goods and services will amount to 95 million. In total, the total retention by the department due to the function shift that occurred on the 5th of April 2015 will equate to approximately 80% of the total allocation. The composition of that is taken into account in terms of the funding norms, 63% of the total fiscal allocation, but we also make a provision for the NFPAS money in terms of compensation that can be utilized for the partial employees. That will give you approximately 80% retention. The TVET subsidies, the 1.1 billion is set up, that will be paid for operational costs for the TVET colleges. And we had to make three payments. The first one was already made in April, the second one will be in September, and January during the next financial year. In terms of student success relating to TVET, we're going to look at a comprehensive teaching and learning plan, which will be developed and institutionalized to monitor and support the colleges in terms of that sector. We're also going to look at a foundation program that will be developed for 8-9 learners wishing to assess the active vocational programs. The branch has identified this as a critical area, as we've identified maths and English as one of the key components that requires a foundational program. We're also going to look at placement tests, which will be developed, that will be aimed to channel learners in suitable fields of study. It's a critical element if you look at this placement test. The department will also develop a protocol for secondment effective specialist colleges. That will obviously be a dual type of a secondment. We would like to place lecturers actually in industry to get the required experience and also to get industry to participate specifically in terms of the training program. The other item we can look at is a video-based lecturer as part of the e-learning system. That's all the funded through grant funds. This will enable the department to actually reach out to a lot more lecturers and the gas pilot program was really done in the civic sector, specifically looking at maths, English, and also the automotive sector. Also, a framework, the next item for partnership development and management will be developed to support cooperation between colleges, industry and government departments, as well as international counterparts. The dual system program will be piloted with newly developed occupational programs to test implementation in the colleges. There will also be a systematic reform of the N40 intakes programs, which will continue under the guidance of the QCTO. Another item we'd also have to look at will be the total NCD policy reform under the guidance of Imolusi. The department is also striving to ensure the minimum 80% class attendance that's also into the NSFAS bursary guidelines to ensure that the allowances will be paid based on 80% class attendance. Development of foundational programs, the student academic support programs, is also part of the student success pathway. The challenges that we're currently experiencing in terms of ensuring student success is still the student's price and damage to property. That's one of the critical elements. Also, lost teaching and learning time due to student and staff lecturer strikes. Also, poor limited career guidance and choice of programs. That's why the property is focusing specifically on the key intervention. And then also the outstanding student certificate is still a challenge. And limited accurate picture of the actual performance of the student service sector. In terms of significant projects and possible risks that the France is investing in, specifically in terms of infrastructure, the new campus site, the department received some funding through the National Skills Fund, the CITAS, the contribution for English access and building of new campus sites. We've got 16 sites located in rural areas. At this stage, we've actually commenced building in three sites, namely Tabazandu, Nkandla A, and Pambanana. One of the key risks for the building of these sites is the ability of the colleges to support increased enrollment. It's similar that was indicated in the university sector. When built these colleges, we would experience some difficulties in terms of operational requirements to ensure that these colleges are sustained in future, but we are in deliberations as well with National Treasury to see what outcomes can be achieved. But there is a dire need to create dedicated infrastructure support grants for the TVET sector. Good. In terms of the TVET funding framework review, the Minister has inaugurated the Ministerial Review Committee to look at the current funding framework for TVET as well as community education colleges, and to make recommendations for the most appropriate funding framework for both these institutions. The main reason for the review is to ensure effectiveness of the funding framework, enabling TVET colleges to play a key role in producing a skilled and capable workforce to support their inclusive growth path. This will culminate in the proposed new or revised funding norms, and then analysis will be performed on the current funding framework and to make international comparative analysis. Another project that's a significant project that the department is engaging in is called PASA CFO, a new resource support project. The department has collaborated with the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants to place qualified chartered accountants as financial management capacity inside TVET colleges. We also placed human resource generous managers in five colleges to assist on HR staff. The main objective of this project is actually focused to ensure effective performance, efficiency, and financial management in the TVET colleges. And like I've indicated, there's a qualified chartered accountants and HR generalists that is in place under this project. In terms of the project inherent system, the project challenges that we're experiencing is to prioritize the 14 management vacancies in the colleges, that's inherent risk. Also, the high CFO vacancy rate. Also, the inability to transfer skills, thus compromising college finance and actual sustainability. Like I've indicated, we've placed these CAs in the colleges, but we'll have to appoint permanent incumbent CFOs to be able to render skills transfer to the officials. Also, colleges might be compromised and destabilized if the vacancies are not full when the project ends. Then we also have the establishment of the South African Institute of Vocational and Continuing Education and Training as a specific aim to improve the quality of teaching and learning in TVET and community colleges. Measures are currently being put in place to perform some of the safe set functions within the department, but for longer-term sustainability, fiscal funding must be considered. If we look at partnerships, how are we leveraging our partnerships? We have established partnerships with the university to support delivery of Level 5 higher certificate programs. programs are being developed in conjunction with other government departments for sports field development, for example, the Department of Health and Transport. Significant partnerships have been established also with international governments who are supporting the following type of projects. We've got South, focusing specifically on lecture development projects. We've got the EU, that's university-based lecture programs that's been developed. We've got GIZ, that's looking at fuel system pilot projects. Tanida, that's student support projects, and also Swiss, because Swiss companies and the Swiss embassy supporting college improvement projects. Actually, if we look at the NSPAS funding, a review in terms of that, the total NSPAS funding for 2015-16 is a total allocation of 2.2 billion. Composition again, if you look at the NCP, that will be 1.2 billion, that represents 56%, and the report 191 will be 725 million, that's approximately 34%, and student allowances will be the difference, that's 219 million or 10%. The bursary funding countries supports approximately 252,000 students. If we have to look at the total requirement of the system to meet all student requirements in terms of the National Development Plan, the total requirement is approximately 22.3 billion. And there's a breakdown there in terms of what the requirement will be. That makes up 22.3 billion, ranging from 5.4 billion in initial for 15-16 up to 9.2 billion in 17-18. In terms of cost containment measures, which I also indicated by my colleague earlier in the discussion, the department is monitoring evaluating the activities, also the strategic targets through the following principles and the M&E principles that we imply. We are researching the TVET College strategic plans that's been developed in conjunction with the department. We also have the e-college strategic plans approved by the minister. We also enter into performance agreements of the TVET College principles, and the monitoring and evaluation framework is currently being considered in terms of the M&E for quarterly reviews. College Council is also playing an effective oversight role in that regard, and we're also initiating a review of TVET College's annual reports. But yeah, as indicated, it's a more of a desktop analysis due to the limitation and operational funding for the branch to effectively implement M&E strategies. To continue in terms of that, the department is in process to develop an enhanced M&E framework for TVET projects that will include, amongst others, we're going to look at financial governance as well as curriculum oversight processes. This will also include a student support plan. And then obviously cost containment, the measures are also driven in the TVET colleges through the initiation of procurement policy that is initiated and approved by the DG. This procurement policy is aligned to the procurement practices contained by National Treasury and the Public Finance Management Act. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to get over to
you. To sum the proceedings from the side of the department. The department acknowledge and appreciate the current funding and appropriation for the post-school education and training sector. But based on the assessment of the department appropriation, it would not be possible to meet all the NDP goals and white paper imperatives as articulated above in respect to the needs of the system, the program, and certain critical intervention areas. Additional funding would be required to meet goals and ensure the effective expansion of the system, including the required support to ensure all funded entities effectively spend transfer funds and meet their performance targets. The department also acknowledges that improvements are required in terms of student success in relation to throughput in the post-school education and training system, and remains committed to ensure that the budget is aligned with the broader sector to ensure the effective performance in terms of outcome five. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister and DG and other officials. Members, let me allow you to raise your question and, of course, input, suggestions, and so on. Once we are done with that, I will allow all of us to take a short break. I see there is a refreshment back. That goes for our host. our visitors as well. We have to serve them. In terms of African culture, we don't do that. We then come back to deal with the responses from departments. So, members, honourable members, over to you. Honourable Matopa is first. Honourable Nyalumi next. Honourable Manana. Honourable Feig. Honourable McLaughlin. Honourable Shoka Vitole. In that order.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Welcome the presentation by the Minister, DG and team. We know that this is a very critical department and the future of our children. And it is so important that we see progress in this particular department. And the Minister, we want to congratulate you. We can see that you are hard at work. And also, you have really implemented the programs. I see when I was reading the performance of the department, I saw that you really, because I'm following the expenditure trend, that you really spend like 90% and above, which is really promising. To say that when we give money, or we have appropriated the funds, or we recommend that the funds to be appropriated in the department, they are really spent. I want to check, Honorable Chair, here. In the previous year, the department has successfully increased the number of skilled youth by expanding access to higher education and training. But I'm not sure, Chair, there is a challenge that we had when the Statistics South Africa was doing the presentation to say that the blacks in South Africa, they are having 2% skills when it comes. Because where I come from, I see the people that have been staying at home for a long time, now they are in the colleges, they are being flooded there. I'm not sure, Honorable Minister, what is the reason for that? Is it not the challenge that we are still facing in the professional council where the black people are not really being accepted well? Others, we used to get a report to say that when they go there for engineering, they are being made to make tea. And as a result, a lot of money that the government is funding, but as a result, are not talking to what the resources that the government put, if it is true that 2% of the black people, because in your presentation you have indicated a lot of the increase in the resources for the black child, especially those poor children. But when it comes to that, I'm not sure whether it is professional councils that are not yet transformed, which is a challenge that I don't know, Honorable Minister, how do we go about just creating that particular field of the professional council, because it's still those old people that are not really transformed. The second one, Honorable Chair, regarding the shortfall in the funding for NSF cited on slide 19, particularly with reference to the increasing demand, has the department discussed the issue with the National Treasurer and other relevant stakeholders? And what is the outcome of such deliberations, if it has taken place? And then around the issue of the 86 billion, Honorable Chair, that the department is requesting over the 2015 medium term expenditure framework period to fully fund the qualifying NSFAS students. We want to check, is the amount of that amount based on the projected metric pass rate in the two coming 2 years? Or what is the case if we're saying that we are focusing on this one? And also with regard to the department's admission about the limited on the institutional monitoring and evaluation that has been shown in slide 20, one would like to ascertain what degree has this limitation affected the department's oversight over institutions and important as NSFAS. I'm asking this, Honorable Chair, because there are rumors around on the corruption, around issue of NSFAS, not well monitored and so on and so forth. So maybe one can get a clarity there, because I agree with the department that really the issue of the NFRs, they will need the increment and the medical school, because we have got the shortage of doctors going out. But if there are no funding, really, it becomes a challenge. Maybe something as a standing committee that we have to look at so that we can assist the department. The other thing, I share, in the 2013-2014, there was a concern around the adherence to performance management development system policy. This was a concern within the Department of Higher Education, owing to the fact that managers and supervisors failed to take accountability for officials who did not comply with service agreements. I want to check, Honorable Minister, has the Minister signed performance agreements with the DG so that this thing can be prevented in future, that the DG will go down and also have that performance contract to the employees so that they can be accountable, because we can't recommend appropriation of funds to find that people are not taking accountability of some of the issues that are taking place. So also, we wish to congratulate the department for unqualified audit report and the fact that when the Auditor General has identified misstatements in the report, they really focus on it and deal with it as it has been reported. In one of the reports, I read those things that the department and the DG really focus on the things that have been identified by Auditor General. I think Honorable Chair can pause there now and let other colleagues. Maybe I will come back. Thanks.
Thank you. Honorable Nalung.
Thank you, Mr. President. Let me also thank the Minister and the DG and the staff for giving us this briefing. It's very important for us. My first question will be on NSFAS, although my colleague has already asked about it. Mine is also to check whether what department is doing with people who fake or voice the documents for their kids to be funded. Meanwhile, they can afford to pay for their kids. And then the second one is that all the entities of the department their monthly financial reporting is currently being under consideration. I just want to check what you mean. You mean the entities are not yet fully responding reporting in terms of their financial statements to the department. I just want to be clarified that. And then on page 36, you talk about the agricultural colleges. I just want to check who is responsible for this agricultural college. Is it agriculture department or higher education? And then for now, Chair, I think let me pause there. Thank you very much.
Honorable Malam.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Let me also join those who welcome the report from the Minister and the DG and the staff. Indeed, it was a very fruitful report. It was just an eye-opener. I used to work with the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education and Training, MAMPOS. We always complaining the budget of this department is not enough. You need to do something. And I've been wondering, what is really the problem? But after listening to this report, really, indeed, I'm now convinced that there is money that needs to be allocated more to this department. Chairperson, there are points of clarity that I would like to pose. The first one is on slide 18, where we are talking about the cost containment measures that were mentioned by the Treasury. But you are also indicating that the Department is also looking in other ways in which competitiveness can be improved. Can you share with us what are those? The second one is with regard to slide number 20, bullet number 2. Can I get clarity there? I think Treasury is also part of us here so that they can clarify what I heard, that this project was established and it was supposed to be funded, but since then there is no funding coming forward. If they can just clarify for us, what is it? Slide number 21, where we were talking about the higher education big project. As Minister, there was a report that was published some 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, where they were indicating that there was a study which was conducted in the different higher education university or TVET with regards to the relationship amongst the students. Is it not possible if we can just receive that report so that it was actually a good report, this was a very good report, so that we can assist as members of parliament, how can we engage with the youth with regards to this? On slide number 51, we are indicating there that there is a great risk with regard to the insufficient operating funds and manpower to monitor and evaluate the project of, what is it? And it seems as if the treasurer is not assisting with this regard. Can we get maybe some reason? What is the problem so that we can engage with the treasurer if possible? Coming to the TVET, one of my colleagues was asking me, what is the TVET now? I'm sure the deficit. That's what the response I said to her. No, to the old deputies, now they are still. In a report, they are indicating that there are 16 sites in rural areas that are going to be under construction. Can you explain to us how are you going to manage the 16? We are starting only 3. How much is the budget for each project? What is the implementation schedule, including the completion date of these projects? Which implementing agents are responsible for this project? The department should furnish us with more information regarding this project, because such information will assist the committee in terms of tracking progress and expenditure performance, particularly in the areas where we're coming from when we're doing the oversight. And my constituency is powerful, and they were busy asking me, we will see that the court date is coming. When is it? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Some issues that I have here. Firstly, regarding the opening remarks by the Minister, firstly, starting with the 18 million people that are not in school, and I do understand that people must be educated, but it's not everybody that wants to become doctors, teachers, and lawyers, and some people don't even want to go to school. So So, you know, it might not be necessary to make provision for all of those. So I'd just like to just a comment on that. How many do you really need to cater for? Because definitely it can't be full 18 million. The funding requirement, I agree with my previous, with the colleagues, colleague that spoke previously, I agree that there is a shortage of funding. However, the funds are limited, so we don't always have a limitless source of funds. So we just need to, my point is that we need to make provision with the funds that we have. Regarding the statement made by the Minister with regards to teachers, and we need teachers and teachers' colleges are there. You see, I just have a problem with that because we previously had many teacher colleges, and those colleges were closed. So was that not foreseen then that we would be needing teachers? We would be needing trained teachers. Sorry. Then you mentioned something about the community college minister and the no interest requirements. Is that not problematic? You know, where people are just accepted without having, you know, in other words, they might not be trainable. So I just have a concern with regard to that statement. Most of the resources for the higher education we get from our schools, and I'm very interested in the statement made by the minister a while ago that in the Eastern Cape, one school is being delivered each week, and up until now, I've been trying to establish a school, three other schools, and just more details of those. As far as that. Okay, can I then move now to the slides, and I just want to make reference to the slides in for clarification. This regards the slide number 6, which talks to your artisan development. I know that has been given over to the sitters now. We also are aware that some of the sitters might not be operating as intended. We did have apprenticeships in the past, those have stopped. So I would just like some more information regarding that. I know later on in the slides you talk about some monitoring, artisan monitoring project. So can we just get some more clarity on that artisan development? Slide number 8 talks about the cedars. Now, yeah, I know the minister is going to be unhappy with what I've said, but that's not my intention. My intention in raising issues are more to ensure that the people of South Africa get what they deserve. Now, the cedars, you know, again, you know, they have failed, in my view. And it's not because of who's running the CITES, it's just it hasn't performed to the intention that it was the desired intention. So I just would like, you know, how are we going to get that right, unless the minister believes that it is the way it was supposed to be. But the CITES, there is a problem there, and we just need to make sure if the intention is good, but I don't think that it's working as per the initial model. Slide number 9 talks to the Slide number 10. Now, to integrate the recognition, the second bullet point there, RPL. Now, I thought this had happened already because clearly, I mean, that is something that should have happened 20 years ago, 21 years ago, that's RPL. So, my question really is, why is this taking so long to integrate or to implement? I thought it was implemented a long time ago, because now it's that it's still in process. Slide number 19. Talk about the sole point of this student financial aid, this website, which is obviously making a lot of people unhappy. Now, my question is that shortfall. What is action has been taken? I know that one of the solutions is to quit more from trade aid. It might not happen in the near future, but what is being done to ensure that the most, I'm using the word most required or students that need it most get the funds instead of those that need it more. So you might find students that are more needy than others. That might be one of the solutions, but it's not happening, it's not going to happen in the near future. That's the one. And then the other issue regarding the NHS, can I ask the collection rate? What is the collection rate? Because some of it is bursaries, which obviously, and some of it is loans. So the collection rate of the loans, is that going according to plan, or what plan is placed to ensure that maximum amount of the loan is collected? 522. Yeah, you see, again, I'm concerned. I liked it when it was introduced, but for me, it's just not working. The seekers, I see the department can't let anyone seek to the five other entities. Well, the question is, does the department have the capacity? Is that not maybe where, because we have your AET centers, your AGET centers, those all need to be monitored, and it doesn't help monitoring in 50% or 100, if you see colleagues 50%, I mean, you'd rather monitor 50, 100%, you know, see the point that I'm trying to get at. So my question is our monitoring mechanism perhaps not good enough? Because I think the third bullet point says the department, however, is not in a position to perform monitoring and evaluation at its fullest extent. Slide number 32. Yeah, these are these new universities in Mpumalanga and Northern Cape. I see it's stated that it is on track. So my question is, on track, are we definitely going to be completed on the due date, which is or the planned date, or is an extension that's been granted, that's the one. And then the other issue that came up regarding these two, and later on, I think it's the other health crisis issue, is the risk of the institutions not being in a position to support increased enrollment in line with infrastructure development. Now, it's good, the risk has been identified, but the question is what is going to be done to resolve that, because unfortunately, all of it revolves around additional funding, and if the funding is not forthcoming, what happens then? That would be my question. I'm not saying I would agree that more money should go for health and education, but you know, it's not happening at this point in time. Maybe somebody should put a list around the Minister of Finance and they can say, we need money or else. Maybe that should happen, but it's not happening. Slide number 44. The allocation of 6.1 billion for the TVET colleges, I know there's an explanation given regarding compensation of employees, subsidies, and then there's an amount of 95 billion to goods and services, and I see there's no detailed explanation of that goods and services. I'm not too concerned about that. My concern is it might be happening, but what do you have policy in terms of the amount spent regarding your areas of concern, for example, SMEs, your ATI components, or does one just spend the money, the 95 million, without bearing that in mind, or without giving consideration to that? I'm nearly done. Two more slides, Honourable Chair. So this slide number 50 deals with, that is the Department of the collaboration with NICA. Very good. I agree. I've seen it in practice. But my question that I have is, what is the cost of this project, and when does this project come to an end? Because I noticed in the late slide that those positions need to be filled permanently. So what are the plans regarding that? And then the last one, Honourable Chair, is on slide number 56. Okay, let me leave that one. Okay, it's about the NP goals. Obviously, NP goals, most of them are not going to be met. So what happens now? Are those goals going to be adjusted, or do we demand the money that's not available? Thanks. That's all for now, Honourable Chairperson.
Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Honourable Minister. This is quite a presentation to be confronted with on Tuesday morning. You said a mouthful. You're in what game? And it's trying to get one's head around. Just as an overall impression, I understand that of your total funding, part of it is utilized for the training of, let's say, learners. Part of it is utilized for the training of the trainers. And part of it is utilized for policing this whole operation. Would it be possible to get a breakdown of how that pans out? How much are we spending on compliance and monitoring? How much are we spending on training the educators, the lecturers, and how much is actually going to the
teaching of those who are supposed to receive the services that your department delivers. I was just interested to find out what the balance is between those three factors. If I can refer you into specifics, just a few clarities, if I may. On slide 8, you speak of expanding the available opportunities for workplace training for students in colleges and universities. At first blush, that seems contradictory to me. Surely you can't have a workplace opportunity in university, or can you? And if so, can you just explain to me what it meant by that? I would have understood that it meant a training within a work situation, not within a university or a college, but perhaps I'm just not seeing it the way you are, and I'd like an explanation, please. Slide 10, a similar sort of thing. The first bullet point speaks to integrate disability into the broader policy arena. That would seem like a strange thing to do. Are we actually saying integrate persons with disability into the broader policy arena? Or am I misunderstanding that as well? Perhaps just a clarity there. Slide 12. So, basically dealt with that already. 15. Yes, I just wanted to know, you mentioned in bullet point 2, normal departmental services. You may just perhaps give an explanation as to what those are. What do you regard as normal departmental services, as opposed to everything else that the department does? Slide 17. Sorry, no. On slide 23. Sorry, I'll just go back on slide 22. Between the bullet points 2 and 3 on that, they seem to be contradictory in a sense. Perhaps you could just explain to me. I understand there are numerous challenges. There are policies and procedures in place for the monitoring and evaluation of the entities, and they are not in a position to perform the monitoring and evaluation to its full extent because of the limitations. And then you say all legislative requirements for monitoring and evaluation are performed. So which ones aren't performed then? Because I don't quite follow what you're saying there. Because you say you're not able to do it because of the limitations, but then you say you are actually doing it all. So I'm just not quite sure what the differential is perhaps between these things that you're referring to here. It seems to all refer to the same thing, but perhaps I'm missing it. I just read it as being contradictory. On slide 23, can you maybe just tell us what the present situation is? Because you say in the case of the CETAs, SACRA, QCDO, and so on, monthly financial reporting is currently being under consideration. I presume then that currently it's not happening. Are you considering doing it now, but there isn't anything happening at the moment? Is that correct? And if so, what is the situation? How does one go about this? Are these entities just left to their own devices, and they just ask for funds, and the funds are passed on to them? What actually happens at the moment? Can you maybe just elaborate on that first, please? On slide 26. Your second bullet point, the next slide, says that challenges include the sustainability of the many initiatives introduced, teaching mentoring programs, writing centers. Sorry, just before that, student successes, that's what I'm referring to, the bigger part. How do you measure those successes? What do you identify as being a student success? And how do you identify them and measure them? The student successes you refer to. On slide 27, you make a statement here that who are at risk of dropping out due to their poor educational background. I was a bit puzzled by that because I thought if you had a poor education background, you probably wouldn't be at this level of education in the first place. How is it that you get to this level but you've got a poor educational background? I wasn't quite following how that would happen. Are we saying people who actually shouldn't be in higher education, as Dr. Fick referred to, those who perhaps don't want to be educated, have no real desire or no ability perhaps in that regard, but we try to educate the uneducated? Is that why this would happen, or is it referring to something else? I'm just waiting for my next one, sorry. On slide 32 and 33, this is just referring to the numerous universities.
and the tie-up with the SMU and so on, just generally, is there some kind of intergovernmental action that goes on between the Department of Health and yourselves as regards the specific needs for medical graduates? And do you tie in with that? And do you try to provide the needs they have and therefore design your infrastructure requirements and your student numbers and so on in order to meet the demand there is? I'd just be interested to hear that. And then as regards to the comment that was made that there are doctors returning from Cuba who've been trained there, but they come back there to complete their training. How is it that their training isn't completed in Cuba? What do they still require when they get back there after being trained in Cuba? I would just be interested to know. Slide 37. Sorry, I've dealt with that already. Slide 43. I think the question may have been asked already, but I just wondered, do you have any sort of view towards the future as to how long it's going to take before these grants will come to an end, before the historically disadvantaged institution will catch up the rest? What if you get to a break even where everybody's going to be treated on the same footing? And then lastly, slide 47. Just on the second bullet point there, it says, policy on student attendance, minimum 80% student attendance required in the implementation of, what happens if that is not achieved? What is the consequence? Do people forfeit their right to further education, or are they just given a rap on the knuckles and told to behave? I just wondered what kind of consequences there were for people who didn't toe the line here. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. Thank you, Minister and the Department. I once attended your presentation to the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education. And on that day, you touched my heart. Because one thing, you talked of community colleges, which are long overdue. You know, it is true that South Africans need education. Everybody needs education in South Africa because of the history from which we come. And I'm saying this to the minister because we actually look upon you as with the department, as a department that will actually bring a revolution in the advancement of the citizens of South Africa. We really appreciate what you are doing. You know, in 1984, in Bushbuckridge, I started a small school. I had just acquired skills in computers, and it has been very costly and very difficult. So I said, a community like this is going to be left behind because if I, who was working, struggled to just know the computer, it is Bushbuck which is left behind. And I brought in people and I trained those people in computer and accounting. My difficulty was that I could not do it full time. So I had to work in the morning and train them in the afternoon. So I decided to actually turn it around, train them in the morning. In the afternoon, I took them into the field, the practice I had. I was running a bookkeeping practice. And believe you me, because they actually trained in the workplace, I got orders from the banks, Standard Bank, S&P, other institutions around Bushbuckridge. They placed orders for employees in the business. And many of my trainees are working as I am speaking. I also introduced secretly, though, the Freedom Charter in the classes because I was teaching typing. There was a lesson called speed test, and I used the Freedom Charter for that. Minister, all those students, they are counselors and bush police, they are feeding the department, the business office in Limpopo. One of them is a a mayor of Zambia, as I'm speaking, DKME. One of them is here in the National Assembly, which means the member of government is improper. It's because she actually did the work practically. So I believe in a story of workplace training. It makes life easy for people. It makes understanding simplified. So if we go that route, I think we're going to succeed. I was also impressed today when the DG spoke about rigorous monitoring. Because you see, in the public sector, we have good programs. The difficulty, the weakness, is in the monitoring and evaluation. If we can just be strict on monitoring and evaluation, I think we will succeed. We have got, that is what you told us, but I want to tell us what we are going to do as this committee. There is an act of parliament called Money Bills Amendment and Related Matters Act. We're going to use that one. And I'm proposing, Captain, that we must use this department because we need South Africans to be trained. Unless we actually train South Africans, development will be very hard to come up. And unless this population of this country is trained, we can talk about economic development, whatever. It's going to take it. I think those who were in the fourth parliament remember that we once invited Professor Hai Jun Tang in the ANC caucus. He who actually insisted that for development, for any country to develop, we need to train people. We need to improve the training in communities. Whether it's teachers, whether it's nurses, whether it's people who make it, capabilities must be there. And I think you are on the right path, Minister. We are not, as this collective, including my friends at the corner there, we do have ours to end responsibilities, Dr. Fick and Honorable Member. The Constitution allows us to make laws, to public participation and oversight. I always listen in the legislature when members of parliament stand up and say, the government did not do, where were we? When we fought, did it slip through a revolution? You know, we must do our part. But our responsibility now is to clear the funds and monitor the funds and demand you to appear here and check. We've got all the tools, especially this committee. We've got the parliamentary by the office, we've got Human Rights Council, we've got the FSC, they're all supporting us. We also have the staff research, it's very capable. It's our duty to look after the movement of this money to end. It's not just the responsibility of the department. The department has done their part, they've given us the strategic plan, they have a plan. We must also have a plan to change after this money. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, members and our visitors. Please take some refreshment for 5 minutes, very quickly, and we come back. I think that we are running short of time, and there will be a whole lot of questions that have been raised. 3 to 5 minutes. Can we get back to our seat? You are allowed to take your refreshment while the discussion goes on. We allow the department to respond to some of the questions. If we are not able to go through all the questions, we will request the department to respond to some of the questions on Friday. But we will be able to finish by 1 o'clock, 10 past 1. Thank you very much.
I don't know how much time are we allocated to respond to the questions. They are stipulated.
Let's target 20 minutes. We will review if there is need to do so.
No, thank you very much. I'll ask my colleagues to come in respect to each and every program effect.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, maybe the first one is around the NISPAC and the questions around how the 36 billion was identified and calculated. I'd just like to say that amount of the NTF was talking only to the support for university students. The TLET presentation then indicated if we were also to support TLET students to the same extent, we'd need an additional 22 billion. So altogether, it would be 58 billion that would be needed. The amount was calculated in the research done by the working group, the ministerial working group on CEC education. And what they did was they looked at the students who we would identify as, the proportion of students who we would identify as deserving academically in terms of those that were becoming out of the schooling system and in terms of their financial needs, because it's all about us being able to support poor and working class students through higher education. You had also asked whether or not the DHET was engaged with National Treasury regarding the NSFAS shortfall. And that's to indicate that I think every year we have engaged with National Treasury and we have put through four additional funds for NSFAS. But over the last few years, due to the fiscal constraints, we have been informed that funding would not be made available. Although initially a large additional amount of funding was made available. The issue around fraud and what has been done to stop fraudulent activity in the press, we will be aware, and understandably we have already announced that we are currently undertaking a forensic investigation of the system to see to what extent the allegations around this are true, and to identify the types of fraud that might be happening so that we can close that down. That is currently in process, and we are at the point of appointing a service provider to undertake a forensic investigation. In terms of monitoring and evaluation, there was a question about if we're limited in monitoring and evaluation, how are we actually monitoring and are concerned particularly over aspects such as assess? I think this is the point that has been made. We do monitor and evaluate and oversight of the system, but mostly it's through the desktop and reports. We get reports in terms of our earmarked funds. Every institution that receives an earmarked grant fund has to provide us with an annual report. And in that annual report, there also has to be an audited financial statement that looks at least 60% of the activities that are covered. And each earmarked bond is provided in terms of a specific plan that is provided by university. However, if you take, for an example, the infrastructure efficiency grant, which over the last 3 years has amounted to about 6 billion, and we look at the support that, that the branches able to get for that oversight, there are over 100 different large infrastructure projects that we are monitoring. Now, you would see the difference between us actually going and visiting a project and seeing a building that is being told has been put up and looking at the quality of that building as compared to a report that's provided by university to say, yes, we are doing it and we've met all the requirements. These 100 or so projects are over 88 different campuses, but we have a very small unit of 2 officials that has to oversee that, and the total budget that we have to oversee it is around 200,000 rand. So that is for an amount of over 6 billion, and you can see that is the issue that we are dealing with. We need to have support within our system of officials and funding to enable us to actually do this in a more detailed way. So yes, we do oversight, we do monitoring, we do evaluate the reports, but that part is not the same, of the same quality. The next question really was around the agriculture colleges. Currently, the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, together with the provincial departments, are responsible for the 12 agricultural colleges. However, there has been an indication that the colleges should be transferred to the governance of the Department of Higher Education and Training, and cannot approve that a task team be put in place for us to investigate how this should happen. And it's in this process of putting together the process for the function shift and looking at what risks could be that we've identified funding as the key risk. I think in terms of the higher education aid report that was mentioned, we can find that, send a copy of that report to the committee. In terms of the new universities project, the plan for the new universities project is a 10-year development plan. When we originally put that plan together, we were expecting a higher level of funding, so we've already stretched it to between 10 and 15 years of the longer term. It was divided up into phases. Phase 1 is currently under construction, and phase 1 is I think 17 new buildings that are being put up at the moment. And those buildings are all on track to be delivered in January 2016 for the 2016 intake. By July this year, we will have gone through all the planning for permissions and so on for the next four buildings that will come on track that will need to be delivered for the 2017 intake. And that's how we're doing it, and we're keeping a very strict control over that process. I can say that in the process, we have also made quite a lot of savings because we've managed to keep the contractors very close to the timeline and in some cases are ahead of schedule. In terms of the measurement of student success, there are a number of different measures that we monitor on a yearly basis in terms of the enrollment. The first one is called the success rate, and that is the number of courses passed over the number of students, and that provides us a success rate for the system. And we've seen that, particularly in contact universities where we have foundation provisioning programs rising. The other one is our core cohort studies, which we are doing every year as well, where we look at the four cohorts that go in a particular year, so the cohort that went in 2005, and we track that cohort through their identity numbers through the university system to see how many of them are staying in the system and how many are dropping out. And we have now had this from 2000, I think the first one we did was in 2000, so we've got the 2000, 2001, etc., up to the 2007, the latest one. We need a longitudinal data of about 8 years to be able to deal with it, particularly because so many of the students are part-time and distance students. So it's in those tracking of students that we're seeing an improvement and a lowering of the dropout rate. In terms of the issue of what do we mean by poor educational backgrounds, if students are in higher education, why do they have strong educational backgrounds? We have to be realistic about our basic education system and the products that are coming out of basic education. We don't support students who don't meet the minimum requirements in higher education. So students who are coming into higher education have all met the requirements in terms of having bachelor passes and so on. And but still, they are underprepared for their level of education. And we have to deal with all the students that come in and provide them the best possible support for success. And that's what the Foundation for Visioning programs are for. Are there intergovernmental processes between Health and the Department of Higher Education and Training? Yes. The Department of Higher Education and Training and the National Department of Health have set up something called the Joint Health Science Education Committee. That's a committee that's been established between the two director generals to deal with all aspects of health sciences education and to try and bring us together so that we can plan coherently and ensure that funding is brought together. This committee has only been established in the last 2 years. Prior to that, there was this kind of coordination, but we have seen that it's absolutely essential, and that was linked to a specific request that helped make our universities to expand at a particular time when we were coordinating, and then that made it extremely difficult for both departments, and that's why we're working on this. In terms of the returning given students, they are interested in Cuba to become doctors. When they come back to South Africa, they still have to do the clinical training, and it's about the clinical training aspect so that they can then become registered health science professionals in South Africa, and our universities have to give them support. And it usually takes between a year to 2 years for them to do the required training in South Africa, particularly given the difference in burdens of disease and so on in the two countries. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My first response will be in terms of the construction of the 16 sites. In terms of the 16 sites, that will encompass 3 refurbishments and 30 new sites. In terms of the latest 3 were, like I said, 3 are currently being built. If you look at your Inkandla and if you look at Bambanana, they're about 10% complete. That represents approximately 20-25% complete. In terms of budget, the budgets range from about 120 million to 220 million per site. That's what the lower quarter will obviously be for refurbishment. In terms of the annual performance plan of the department, we need to construct 6 sites by December 2015. Now, the additional 13 sites, we've on tender. The bid evaluation committee will be meeting on the 4th of June to consider the recommendations of the bid evaluation committee, and that will obviously look at those additional 13 sites. But like I say, in terms of IPP, we need to construct 6 by December 15th. And that's in terms of the infrastructure. The next item refers to FACA support the HR project. That project currently owns 50 chartered accountants and has got about 16 actual GM people supporting the project. The CFO project as it currently stands now would terminate in June 2015, but the department is looking at an extension. As indicated earlier, we are experiencing some challenges in terms of the current filling of those positions. That's what we're going to extend to ensure that we don't lose that capacity that was created inside of the TVET College. The current HR project is already extended until December 2015. Because of the total value of the project, it's 206 million to date in terms of this intervention. Thank you, Chair. That's my report. Yes, the additional attendance that links to specifically to the next bus, in terms of what is said within the bursary guidelines, that the students need to attend 80% class attendance before they will be eligible for the travel and accommodation allowance. That is because of the bursary guidelines. So what we've done is the colleges have implemented processes where they are currently managing and monitoring the class attendance. That is also sent through reports to the department on a monthly basis. So based on that qualification criteria, they will only receive those allowances based on the 80% class attendance. That is the internal control measure that has been implemented by the department.
If I may just explain this one. What was happening, some students would just register at the beginning of the year, disappear. You come every end of the month to collect transport money and other related benefits without actually sitting in class and be taught. Now, we had to become a bit wise into saying the question of you being funded by government has to be linked strictly to your attendance, because we're not funding you, we are funding your attendance of classes so that you can attain a qualification and become a better person for yourself, your family, and contribute in the development of the country. So the policy is actually looking at addressing that issue as we have identified it.
There was a question on the performance, adherence to performance management and development system, and there was reference to a 2013 report. The second question was whether the minister has signed a performance agreement with the DC. The question is, in the affirmative, the minister has signed a performance agreement with the DC. In regard to that particular year, the finding was in regard to compliance with the date of the submission of the performance agreement. And currently, we are monitoring, we are taking strict measures for managers who are not complying with the policy. So we have improved in that regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Rose Patel. I'm from the planning branch. I think I just wanted to respond to the general issue of the relationship between the department and National Treasury in regards to some of the pressures and priorities. Now, the honourable member that was speaking of Bush Park Ridge, I think that given that we as a country are facing competing needs with limited resources, and that we as a department one political decision, for example, an appropriation decision is taken, must look at our pressures, spending pressures, robust cost-cutting efficiency and effectiveness measures. We also welcome the role of Parliament in appropriating funding, especially in regard to the money bill. Now, it would be useful for SCOA to always assess our bids and reprioritization submissions that we make to National Treasury, and the responses that we get in regards to them. So, for example, in regards to monitoring and evaluation that honourable members raised, it is really quite a challenge that with an appropriation of which almost 98% goes to institutions and entities where they have inverted commas laxity to be able to utilize these funds, that the department is hamstrung in boosting its monitoring and evaluation capacity. Now, it is clearly that as you devolve, you have to strengthen control and monitoring and evaluation. So what is required is a bit more flexibility within our current budget, rather than even asking for new money, to be able to reprioritize. If we can take 1% of the 98%, it will make a tremendous effect on the department. However, Treasury has not been able to accede to some of those fully motivated cases where we indicated that a shave of 0.5% or 1% of the 98%, which is almost 50 billion rand, to be able to re-strengthen our capability. The number of institutions, for example, under administration, is also a case in point, that they are allowed to be able to get away in this thing. So the 2013-14 AD report recognizes very succinctly that the department is grossly inadequately underfunded to be able to carry out its functions around monitoring and evaluation and putting in control measures. Thank you very much.
There was one question about teacher education and the collection rate for NSFAS. In terms of teacher education, I think in 2007, under the old Department of Education, a process was put in place around the beginning of the Funzili Shaka bursary scheme and the focus on improving the capacity of assistants to produce teachers. Since then, we've been working with not identifying particular campuses that could be opened up and extending teacher education. And at the point we are at now, we are producing sufficient teachers for the system. So it's no longer a situation where we are producing insufficient teachers. However, we are very well aware of the need for us to produce the right kinds of teachers and with the right competences. So that's what we're focusing on. So the teacher education colleges that were identified, an infrastructure that is not there in the system. We have a lot to go to see which ones should be utilized for teacher education, but really, I think that's what the minister was making, is that we need them for post-school education more generally, community colleges for the skills, teacher skills, and multi-purpose centers. So we need to look at those, and that's for teacher education. We're not talking about trying to open them all up for teacher education now. It's rather about how do we support the post-school education system more effectively, and given that those resources are out there, that infrastructure is out there, how could we utilize it? But of course we would need funding for that. In terms of the next question on recoveries, NSFAS does attempt to recover funds from loans. However, it needs to be understood in terms of the overall use of the system. It's only for university education students because the teachers college students are all bursaries. Secondly, students do get part of their loans converted into bursaries. There's a final year program which, if they're successful, 100% of the loan gets converted. And in previous years, successful students have 40% of their loan being converted. That means the amount of the loan is much lower than one would expect the total amount for the loan. Then the interest rate kicks in 1 year after a student has completed, and it's at that particular point that that loans can be collected back. Only after a student has now become debtor and has got a job in which they are earning more than, I think at the moment, 30,000 per annum, can NSFAS actually try to claim back funds. So you can see the collection rate is affected by all of these different policies in place. But we understand that because these students are poor students and they acquire that kind of support going forward. So the collection rate in terms of the total loan book is quite small. I think the amount being collected every year is in the order of about 700 million. The CFO is supposed to correct me if I got that wrong. I think it's around about that amount per annum that has been collected coming back. But another real difficulty that NSFAS has in terms of collection is that you have to get positive consent from the debtor at the point at which they become a debtor, which is 1 year after they have completed their program. And we need to restore a cultural mindset change amongst the students who benefit from this test to be willing to pay back and to sign up as debtors. Thank you.
Chairperson, just on a few matters, just to add to what Mr. Pitta was integrating regarding the reprioritization exercises. I think that's a very critical issue, that during the budget process, the department would be allowed to reprioritize existing funding to address specific needs. Then in terms of the questions on what does non-operational cost mean, those, which is the 1.2% that we refer to, now that specifically refers to any kind of normal operations that we have, excluding our transfer payments and specific earmark funding like the payment of our building. If we can specify that, it's issues like maintaining the Indela workshops, it's hosting the students at the Indela hostels, it's all our examination services, any monitoring activities that we perform, all our normal administration expenses, like water, electricity, telephones, photocopying, etc., travel, and everything that links to that. The other aspect is the minimum requirements of the various entities in terms of their reporting and the legal requirements that they meet compared to the issue of monthly financial reports. The legal requirements of an entity, for example, would be that on a quarterly basis they must submit a report on performance and financial performance to the minister. That report is due every quarter, 1 month later, to the minister. So those are met. And those are legal requirements in terms of the PFMA and the regulations, and all the entities adhere to that, and we ensure that we receive those reports. However, for us to improve the monitoring and to be a little bit more knowledgeable of what's happening at entity level, we want to, for example, implement monthly financial reporting to see if there is a risk that's identified that we can further act on that specifically. So therefore the issue of other possible monitoring and evaluation implementation aspects so that we can identify risk and problems at our entities a bit sooner. The last one is just the issue around cost containment and effectiveness improvement. They specifically, the Director General instituted specific cost containment measures, which is a standing thing. It runs from one financial year to the other. We implemented the additional measures announced by National Treasury. In terms of the effectiveness improvement, now, there we say, while we have cost containment measures, we might perhaps be able to improve on the effectiveness in which we perform certain activities. We may do electronic meetings, we may have electronic documentation rather than my photocopy. There are numerous examples. Those we are looking at, and we want to see what the impact of that would be also to reduce costs. Thank you, Chair.
The few remaining questions. Now, in respect to the integration of people with disability in the system, what we're actually talking about here is that all our institutions, colleges, or any other facility that offers training, we must make it a point that our policy compels each and every one of our facilities into providing the necessary infrastructure that a person with disability is requiring. The facilities in the form of equipment and other related facilities, including assistive devices, should actually be provided as a standard practice in order to ensure that the conditions under which students with disability are subjected to in the learning and training environment within post-school education and training system should not act as a hindrance towards them displaying their potential and achieving their goals. That's what it actually means. We want it to be integrated. It must not be addressed accidentally as a separate issue in the system. With regard to RPL, RPL, by and large, it's more out there in various pockets. What we are doing, we are working and integrating the recognition of prior learning within and in the entire system, such that it is institutionalized and forms part of that we are talking about, to an extent that nobody is left out, or you have to travel 500 kilometers in order to get that kind of assessment. It will be available in our facilities throughout the entire city. That's what we mean by integrating it with that dedicated focus at the present moment. Now, in regard to the speakers, you know, speakers are actually key in providing spaces for learnership, apprenticeships, as well as artisan development. And this they are doing with respect to the sector skill plan, as well as service level agreement they enter into with the Department of Higher Education and Training. And the targets that they have to achieve form part of the overall target that the department has to actually achieve. And for the record, in respect to supporting students who need National Student Financial Aid Scheme, at the present moment, I think all figures combined, they are contributing just over 400 million a year in order to ensure that these kids to attain professions and qualifications they desire for themselves in order to attain and pursue the careers they are looking for. And over and above that, there are quite a number of programs that each and every state run with our respective colleges as well as universities. I think in the presentation, honorable members may have picked up or some of the examples of what ETTC, for instance, is doing with universities in respect to offering of some programs. So there is a lot of work that the speakers are actually doing to fulfill the mandate that we have as a department of providing education and training to young and old in the country. So I think this one is really important to emphasize for the record. And the other area, perhaps, NDP goals. No, we're working towards achieving NDP goals in their totality. And it's a question that is buttressed also by the imperatives of the white paper that we developed in respect to the question of post-school education and training in the country. The challenges that we confront, we'll address them as we encounter. And if there are certain interventions that are required, we will work on those in collaboration with the Treasury and other government departments as well, and also including within the entire system itself. So there is nothing that we are dropping in that sense. The National Artisan Moderating Body, what we have identified in the system was that the training of artisans largely is not standardized and properly coordinated. For instance, if you get an electrician who is working in the motor industry, that electrician is not similarly qualified as an electrician who is working in the construction industry. So what we are doing in respect to the national, the NEM, we call it NEM, is to standardize the offering of programs across the entire country so that if an electrician is trained and qualified, you know that this is an electrician that will be able to handle every situation that requires electrical work. And this is what we are talking about, so that we are able to improve and harmonize skills acquisition so that we are able to make the meaningful impact that the country has to make in respect to the question of skills training. Because it's not just a question of free for all, it must be properly coordinated, standardized, and professionalized. That's what we are doing. Let me give over to you.
your permission, just a few questions, some of which are directed specifically at myself. I think that the issue of SSA and the number of professionals and so on, look, all the signs are pointing to the fact that some of the measures that we've been taking in improving access are beginning to yield positive results. For instance, one statistic that is interesting is that for the first time this year, students who are studying accounting in universities, the majority are black. That's for the first time. So we've also seen similar indicators. But of course, investment in education doesn't just pay back in a matter of a couple of years. Sometimes it can take a decade before we begin to see. But I don't think it should just depart, Chair and Honorable Members, from also the point that Honorable Manchopa is raising, gatekeeping. It is still a serious problem. And one of the, we've identified that, and one of the ways we are seeking to deal with that is we are introducing an interesting system called occupational teams. Where, for example, if I can take the example of DG electrician, we'll bring all the people who are involved in electrical engineering, either as artisans or as professional engineers or as engineering technicians. You bring together universities, you bring together employers who make use of those, and you bring together professional bodies and registered. And say, in one room as representatives of these, where are the blockages? Either at universities or in the professional area of training and registration. For instance, we find that a lot of black engineers, once they graduate, they don't sometimes get exposed to the kind of work experience that is needed. That's part of our focus on work experience, by the way. And that's what we are talking about when we are talking about university students and workplaces. By the way, some of the programs require a place for completion. You can't complete a diploma in any engineering field without spending at least 8 months or 9 months at the end of the program so that you qualify. Just like an apprentice requires a workplace. So it's something that we are working on. It's not easy, but we are quite convinced that in the end we're going to crack this. Because what we also want to put to an end, this thing of the supply side, second guessing the demand side and vice versa. We want that there are platforms to actually talk about it. We appreciate the positive comments that members have made, including some firm commitment to support us to get more money. Honorable Manana would love that. We wish that all the parties we know in this committee will push for that. Now, the 18 million that we are talking about is what our research indicates as adults who actually do require some access to further education of one type or the other, or acquiring a skill or training and so on, and we are not catering for them at the moment. So it's a huge, huge, huge demand. By the way, also the other complication now, something that we haven't spoken about, is distance learning. Today, Tunisia, a huge number, I don't know what percentage now of students who are at Tunisia, who are actually full-time. That's not what Tunisia was meant for originally. It was meant for working students. But increasingly, students who do not get places in your residential university, they register to UNISA. And that's blocking space, by the way, for the kinds of adults who may be wanting to do genuine correspondence whilst working. Just a few other... No, there's no problem with the policy of no admission to the community college. What do you do if someone pitches up and say, I can't read and write. I want to read and write. I want to learn how to read and write. What requirement are you going to need from the person? Other than to say community colleges must be able to teach you. If someone started to arms up and say, I want to do banking, Why should that person be trained how to beg? With the standard two. I don't say so that means that we want accessible colleges that will respond, because that's the idea we are working towards, you know, but that will respond to all the needs of those South Africans who are no longer, and the likely, by the way, to go back to school. The issue of one of schools being open weekly in the Eastern Cape, that's a responsibility for the Department of Basic Education, not us. But having said that, nevertheless, it's true that the Department of Basic Education has been opening a school a week in the Eastern Cape. I know that for a fact, that it is true. Myself, I've opened one of those schools, very nice schools, you know, which are very good. Now, I've asked the DG, I've said to the DG, DG, I'm about to finish that. Let's focus on building capacity of the department to do monitoring and evaluation. And we are focused on that. For example, we are impounding the money that has not been spent by the CETA. And we want to redirect those monies to building capacity of the system to be able to monitor and evaluate itself. So we agree there with members that that's absolutely essential, and it's something that we are at the moment really prioritizing. DG has spoken about disability. That's what I was wanting to deal with. A nice example, Honorable Shope, of teaching students. I do touch typing, by the way. Yes, I went to some institution to learn touch typing. I would have liked to have learned touch typing by typing the Freedom Charter. This was very innovative and creative. The last point is, we are exploring every avenue, not just for funding, but to also ensure, excuse me, increased access. Let me tell you, for instance, the big problem, one of the big problems we are sitting with isn't kids who have finished matric but are sitting at home. Now, one of the things, for instance, we are doing there, we are now resuscitating or expanding what are called higher certificates. Higher certificates would be for those students who are not necessarily be admitted. Let's put it to the specific, if you're 40-49% category of matric, who have not passed, but they've got the potential. Especially also your math and science matriculants who have gotten between 40% and 49%. You'll find many of them actually are quite capable. The reason is that some of them might not have a teacher. They were a qualified teacher when they were actually doing the final. You want to mop them up using your higher certificate, which is not really a repetition of matric. It assists them to do the subjects again, but go beyond what is just in matric, so that one foot is already at first year level five universities. And if they finish those higher certificates, they can be admitted to any program at university or get employment, some of them. So these are the things that we are also now saying to universities, work more with TVET colleges to offer some of your higher certificates so that we expand the number of sites to offer the higher certificate. That's why we want to absorb a lot of these materials in numbers. That is actually one of our goals. And here's the last point. You know, since 1994, maybe even prior to that, I don't know, we've never had adult education being headed by anybody above the level of a director, both at national level and in the provinces. Now, then, we've got this 8 million. 18 million, sorry, that we're talking about. So what then was decided as a department is that we're going to now form a fully-fledged branch on adult education that's also going to look after community colleges headed by Deputy Director General. Because unless we do that, we are not taking this area seriously. In other words, we've got much more people than we ordinarily realize who require further education and training that we are unable to deal with because as a country we have not really put this priority at the level as it actually deserves to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister and officials. You know, we
I think I was beginning to appreciate that the Department of Higher Education Training seeks to educate and train our people on a mother scheme. Regardless of where you have stopped your education, regardless of whether you ever saw a classroom in the first place, I think that that's a revolution in itself. Because this then seeks to enable our people to actively participate in the economy of the country in a meaningful way, reduce dependence on the state, and in fact begin to contribute themselves to public revenue. And I think that it is critical that we take this seriously. It is important to attract and capture those who, for various reasons, would have not been exposed to education in the first instance, or would have dropped out at a particular point. Some of whom, as the minister said, may not even have had access to the school because of their geographical location. And when a community college is created, it is only then that they become exposed and education becomes accessible to them. Secondly, we must achieve the goals of the National Development Plan, all of this. And this department plays a key role in doing that, in achieving those. And so, you know, Minister, I always make this example that we very often call certain people bush mechanics. And they keep the minibus taxis on the road every day, and they transport us to work and back. We take our sedan to them, and they panel pick them, they do all sorts of mechanical work, and we drive to work and back. But we still call them bush mechanics. And the simple reason is because once they have the skills, they don't have the papers to prove that they are mechanics and that they are panel fitters. Speaking to some of them, they say, well, we can't even register our businesses and go and work openly because we don't have professional certificates. And so what happens is that they can't even claim from this huge industry, the insurance, the vehicle insurance company industry. So in many ways, they are lost to the economy of the country. In many ways. And they're not the only ones. The minister is making an example of somebody who wants to be qualified as a baker and register officially a business and enter the space and contest the economic space like anybody else. And so the issue of capturing all of these people, putting them through the education and training basis, and upon qualification, giving them, awarding them the certificate, is going to make a huge change to the life of our people in many different ways. And that was the issue of pursuing additional funding, because funding will never be adequate, but at least additional funding is a matter that this committee has got to be seized with on issues related to education, on health, on water and sanitation, issues that make life easy to our people. And that's what we are challenged to do as this committee. And so, Minister, DG, and officials, if we hear your plea for additional funding, we understand it, given the direction to which you are taking the higher education. And you have our support. I dare say we will have our support in a meeting as open and as public as this. Thank you very much for availing yourself, Minister. Thank you, DG and your officials, for being available to this meeting today. Emma, thank you very much. But you will have to stay behind for a couple of minutes. We have a few things to tire. We will release the minister and the officials now. Thank you very much. Members, we have a set of minutes to adopt, which are before you. Let's look at the minutes of the 22nd of April. If you recall, those minutes were deferred because we asked the Secretariat to add a few things. I recall that it was Honorable Fee who made that point. And those minutes have now been amended accordingly. They are before us now. 20th of April. I hope we don't have to go page by page now. Honorable Fee?
Yes, it's just that I move the acceptance of those minutes. I'm going to look at it now and I'm happy on the case.
Seconder? Honorable Manana. Thank you. The minute of the 15th of May, that's when we met the Department of Human Settlement. So make sure that on the front page your name are recorded correctly and that you are recorded present where you were present. The second page. Page 3. There are decisions that we made on that day, two of them. Any movement? Honorable Marusa, Senator, Honorable Mandova. And the next set of the minutes of the 19th of April. Which are a record of our deliberations to the Public Service Commission. Page 1. Two. Summary of decision at the end, 6.1 and 6.2. Mova, Honorable Manana, seconder, Honorable Nyalung. Last set, 22nd of May, water and sanitation. That was last Friday, 22nd of May. page 1. 2. Page 4. Decision at the end. The committee invites the Department of Water and Sanitation, Cooperative Government, and Traditional Affairs, National Treasury, and South African Local Government Association to discuss challenges with the value chain of water supply and fresh out funding arrangements that can help to unblock constraints and capacitate municipalities for the provision of water and sanitation. Honorable Monana, you want to cut the sentence into 2 or 3 short. Oh, that's, so we have a full stop at water supply, and then where it starts supply, and fresh out funding, we arrange that into a second resolution. Is it fine?
Mm.
Yes, honorable member. Okay. So we end searching out the funding arrangement full stop. Arid? Right. If we do that, then we exclude that the rest of the sentence. Then that would probably be the consequence of that kind of question, isn't it? Or the outcome of that. All right. With that amendment, yes, honorable member.
Yeah, I think it's important that we retain both water and sanitation. It's only in large sections, so I'm going to scrap the second part of it, and I would suggest we add in the challenges of the value chain, water supply and sanitation, and dash out funding arrangements. But we have sanitation must be in it as well. Now look, what I'm saying is in the third line, where it says to discuss challenges of the value chain of water supply, add the words and sanitation in after water supply there, and flash out from the arrangement. Stop. Otherwise, if you just left sanitation out, I think it's important that you keep it in there. Thank you, Chair.
Agreed. All right. Move up for adoption. With that amendment, Honorable Manana. Second, Honorable Mustafa.
Yeah.
Thank you. The meeting and the minutes are done. Members, thank you and our staff. Thank you very much. The meeting stands again. Until tomorrow. We meet tomorrow.
Thank you.
M46 at the computer room. M46 at
5:00
9:00.